You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, dog fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank.
Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, welcome back to the fish tank right here on the Miami Dolphins Podcast Network. Seth Levitt, DJ Preach, and OJ Juice McDuffie. Juice, how you feeling today, man? With you got the big logo on the new hat. You're looking sweet. What's going on?
What's up, Big Seth? You know, man, I got to always represent, man. You know, it's my squad, man. Since 93,
yeah.
You know, my Dolphins are my squad. And especially when we're rolling like this, man, you got to always represent. I represent on bad days, too.
And, yeah, I was going to say.
We've all seen some bad days, man. And our guest today, man, he's seen a couple and some good ones, man, with the squad. So we know how that roller coaster ride works, but we on a high right now, baby.
Yeah. He brought us a lot of good days.
And he,
you know,
sure
what,
did.
We say that. I don't know what day this is. We're going to publish this episode probably sooner than later because I know it's going to be fire. But right now, the team, as we're recording this, stands at 6-3. The best record since I worked there in 2001 is absolutely insane. And it's a lot of fun. So just feeling good. But today, as we always do in the tank, we dial it back and talk to some of the guys that laid the foundation for these guys that are doing it now. And I am fired up that Johnny Williams helped us find this man, Devon Best. How you doing, man? Welcome to the tank.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah.
He's looking good too, man, Seth. You know, it's wideouts, man. Wideouts always look good, man.
Yeah. What was that?
Look good, play good.
Hey, but you know what they say, Juice? You look good, you play good, man. You know how it is.
That's right. The first and foremost right there, man. You got to get that.
Right.
Make sure that's right first, and then the rest will take care of itself.
Absolutely. Always fashion forward in the wide receiver room. You know, yeah, regardless of what era, what generation. I mean, you go back to Paul Warfield. I mean, who was Paul Warfield? So it's definitely something about that position. Well, look, we're going to get into a lot here, D-Best, but since we are talking about two wideouts, and Juice has we can't go two episodes without having a wideout in. So we just had Bob Baumhauer. We had Brandon Marshall before him. Yeah, we had A.J. Dewey, but we had Camarillo before him. So he it's like a rule in his contract that we have to have wideouts on here. So you are fulfilling his contract, which we appreciate. But I've always wondered, when guys come in, I remember when Zach got here, everyone said, oh, you should watch Nick Bonacani play. How much did you know about OJ McDuffie, given not just being a wide receiver, but the way you guys approached the game and what your responsibilities were on that field? How much did you know about OJ's game?
I knew a lot about him. Actually, you know, I was younger, but he was one of those guys that, you know, brought a lot of energy. You know, obviously he excelled at moving the chains, you know, and caught the ball really well. So those things stood out to me, and I always kind of kept that in the back of my head, you know, when I was playing, you know, to make sure, you know, you look the ball in, you know, you just work on the fine crafting things, you know, your route running, reading the coverages, you know, right, and just trying to get it going. So he's one of those guys I always looked up to. And it was an honor to meet him when I first got down there. And, you know, I always play with a chip on my shoulder because of him.
Yeah, like
one of my favorites right there. One of my favorites, Big Seth, man. And I watch his game, and I saw a lot of my game. I think D-Best is probably half step faster than me, you know, but the way he played with toughness, mixing it up, blocking, you know, running routes on the inside, man, you know, finding those niches, those holes, moving the chains himself, man. Just a lot of fun watching D-Best play. And bringing that energy, man. That energy was contagious for the team, man. So, yeah, no doubt about it.
So, Devon, we had when Brandon was here, a lot of times I'll introduce Juice as the man with the best hands in the podcast business. And I felt a little nervous with B. Mark. He said, Juice had better hands. But if you want to talk about Yak, you know, like that might be a different conversation.
That's funny, man. You know, he might be right, though. But, you know, as a receiver, you know, those are golden rules you want to live by, you know, is having them hands, you know, repetition, catching the ball. So, you know, Brandon was a beast when it came to the Yak. You know, no, he was hard to get down. You know, guys didn't want to tackle him. Big guy and, you know, and Juice, you know, always, like I said, moving them sticks, catching the ball and, you know, looking for the next play, you know, whether it's in the run game, passing game, whatever it may be. So I try to, like me personally, I try to pride myself at doing both, you know, having that Yak and catching the rock. You know how it is.
Nice.
You know, be best. They try to call us possession receivers, man. Yeah, I said we make sure we keep possession of the football. You know
that's right. That's
bottom
right.
line right there. But
you know, they kind of said the same thing about me when I was coming out of college. You know, he's a possession guy, he's a system guy. And, you know, I always thought to myself, isn't that part of the strategy is to run your system and execute your system, whatever system it is you're in, you know,
right.
and the possession tag, you know, you want to get as many possessions as possible, move the sticks and keep your offense on the field. So I never understood that, man.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about that in a little bit, man. But let's get it started, Big Seth. You know what I mean? Because your story obviously is very fascinating, especially during your early years. You know, things weren't always the easiest for you, D-Best. And so let's talk a little bit about growing up in Oakland, some of the things you had to face at a young age, and, you know, and then where football and Coach Beam at Skyline High School, you know, came in, they fit into your life. You know, there's a lot of things that a lot of people probably don't know about you growing up, man. You want to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like you said, man, I grew up in Oakland, California. You know, a lot of drugs, a lot of gangs, a lot of violence. You know, my mother had me at the age of 15 years old, man. So she was a kid herself, you know. So I grew up without my father. And it was tough at times. But, I thank the Lord every day, you know, for having a strong mom and a strong family that supported her, you know, while she was in the process of having me or whatever. But sports became my father, you know, and I always found a mentor or a father figure in whatever coach that I was playing for, you know. So that basically kept me focused, man, kept me on the right page. You know, I bumped my head a few times here and there, you know, like we all have. But I think overall, I'm thankful for, my mom putting me in sports at a young age and being able to have those mentors and guys basically to lean on in times of need. You know, my mom was working a lot. So she wasn't really around, you know, as much as she wanted to be. She had to put food on the table, clothes on our backs. And, I had those mentors who stepped up to the plate, you know, would take me to Raider games, to Oakland A's games, you know, and, you know, made me cherish, you know, those moments and treated me, you know, like I was a kid and experienced a lot of memories, you know, made a lot of memories, you know, so. It was tough, but looking back, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, man.
And what about Coach Beam and growing up with Coach Beam and everything and what you had to go through, you know, at your high school and things like that, man? I mean, there's a lot that you had to deal with in that situation. Talk about people you looked up to that kind of carried you along, man. What about Coach Beam?
Absolutely, man. So going into my freshman year in high school, I hadn't played football. Like a lot of people don't know this. I didn't play tackle football until my sophomore year in high school. One of my good friends on the basketball team was like, you know, D-Best, why don't you come out for the football team, man? I think you'd be good. And I was like, nah, you know, I was a little nervous. You know, I never played tackle, never put on a helmet or nothing, you know. So I was like, all right, forget it. I'll just do it. Ended up making a JV team my sophomore year. And, I had some pretty good success. And next thing you know, Coach Beam moved me up to varsity for the playoffs my sophomore year. And that was an eye-opening experience, you know, because it was a quick transition. You know, it was like going from JV to varsity is a big jump. You know, obviously guys are bigger, stronger, faster. But he made me confident in myself, like, oh, I can play this game. I can do this. You know what I'm saying? So long story short, you know, Coach Beam got into the picture. He started introducing me. You know, I started having success on the field. He started introducing me to college coaches. And that kind of blew my mind, you know. Where I'm from, you know, a lot of guys don't make it out. You know, a lot of guys end up, you know, I hate to say it, either dead or in jail, you know, just because of the circumstances we put in, you know. So when he started introducing me to college coaches, that opened my eye and said, you know, you got an opportunity, you know, you can make it out, you know. So I grinded, you know, and he was instrumental into that. You know, I remember one particular moment he brought in, you know, guys from recruiting coordinators from the Pac-10 at the time, Mountain West. And he got all these college scouts in his office, and he called me into his office one day, and he put out my transcript. I was a junior, I believe. He put out my transcript in front of all these coaches, and I'm saying to myself, man, this is not gonna go good, because I know like my grades wasn't too good going into my junior year, man. So he put my transcripts out, and all these coaches are looking around. They're like, man, he's a great athlete. We love how he play. We love his hustle. We love the way he run routes. We love the way he catch the ball. But his grades aren't there. And I looked at that two ways. You know, the first way is like, you know, he was telling me to man up. You know, you gotta man up, man, and handle your business, you know, because I didn't have nobody in my corner, like I said, telling me that school was just as important as your success on the field. You know, the two didn't match up at the time, you know. And he put me on the spot. And I think I needed that. So I ended up getting my stuff together. I was taking online classes. I was taking classes at another independent study high school, whatever. I was going to my old teachers from my freshman and sophomore year, trying to make up grades and do work to get a better grade to boost my GPA. That way, when I took the SAT, they balanced out. And if it wasn't for Coach Bean, man, you know, I wouldn't have had that opportunity. And, you know, like I said, he was more than just a coach. He taught us discipline. He taught us how to, you know, man up and forget the circumstances that you're in, you know, because stuff happens. That's part of life. That's part of growing up, especially coming from a city like Oakland. He knew the challenges that were already stacked against us, you know, so he brought the man out of us, you know, and made us better men on and off the field. So that definitely worked in my favor.
Now, Devon, for those of us like DJ Preach who like to Netflix and chill, we watched Last Chance U. And so, man, I knew of Coach Beam from the time that you and I had to work together with the Best Route Foundation, which we're going to talk about later. And then, of course, Sonia, who was working with the foundation, his daughter, which was really cool to see her there as a mom and everything. So it was fun to watch. It was a great season, but it was also fun to watch that, to get to know this man that I knew was instrumental in your life more. Did you watch that season, and how much of the Coach Beam that we saw on Netflix, like how much of that is reality TV bullshit, and how much of that is like, yo, that's Bean. That's who he is.
I tell you one thing, Coach Bean loved the camera, man. He's definitely a cameraman, but what you see is what you get, though. He's raw, you know. He's uncut. He says what he feels.
Oh man!
And most importantly, he cares about his players, man. My senior year in high school, I'm sorry for going back, but my senior year in high school, we sent about 10 players Division I to Division I college, you know, and that was something he was doing every year, basically, you know, sending guys to college, you know. So when he got to Laney, he basically was doing the same thing, man, same mindset, same thing, getting players from messed up situations, bringing them over to Laney, give them a second opportunity, some of them coming from jail, coming from sleeping in their cars, just all kind of situation. And Coach Bean, you know, he put his hand over your shoulder and take you in like you his, you know. And it all works out at the end of the day. But like I said, Coach Beam is one of them raw, uncut guys. And what you see is what you get. He doesn't bite his tongue. And I think it works, you know, to all of our benefit.
Yeah, it clearly did. And you could see that. I mean, one of the things, you know, and this is going to be about you, but it was interesting to hear what you just said. And that the whole time, he wanted to win ball games, but he wanted those guys to think about playing at the next level. And the next level for them was just a bigger school. You know, like, do you want to be in a junior college the rest of your life, or do you want to go to D1? And so that was really cool. But man, he was something. He was tough on that RJ kid. My God, he would be.
Oh yeah, yeah, man. You know, he has his guys too, and you know, I'm lucky enough. I was one of his guys. My junior year, my sophomore junior year, I played receiver, and then my senior year in high school, he brought me to his office and asked me to play quarterback, and I was like, you know, he was like, you do this for me, I'll get you to college, you know. And I was all in, you know. So I was one of his guys, and he rode me, you know. He rode me in the classroom, rode me on the field. You know, you do right by him, he'll definitely do right by you.
Yeah, well, and so clearly he did, and you did. Obviously, you did your part, but Coach Bean was working for you. And so let's talk about that for a second. A standout career there at Skyline, and it leads to a scholarship from Oregon State. And then your life is just turned upside down. You know, and I feel like everybody knows this just because we work so closely together. But I know that I was talking to Juice and he didn't even know the whole story. So talk about the incident that changed your life and ended up sending you to the Byron Boys Juvenile Ranch?
Absolutely. So I remember like it was yesterday, man. It's not a day that goes by that I don't count my blessings and I don't think about it. First and foremost, I must say that. But with that being said, I graduated high school in June. I believe it was June 13th, 2003. And the incident happened July 9th, I believe. I was 17 years old. And I had some buddies, you know, like we all do. And, you know, we all got buddies that's up to no good doing whatever they're doing, you know. And I got a phone call to pick up my friend or whatever. And they was out doing some things they ain't had no business doing, stealing and all kind of stuff. So I picked them up literally 5 minutes after they load the stuff in the car and get in the car. We get pulled over by the police. And I'm the driver. So it's five of us. I'm the driver. I'm the oldest. And next thing you know, we're all handcuffed on the side of the road. And I'm looking and I look over and they just pulling out all this stuff out of the truck. And I'm just saying to myself, oh, my God, it's over. It's over for me. You know, I just got my scholarship. I just literally bust my ass to get this scholarship. Excuse my language, but
all good,
it's,
man.
It's done deal for me. You know what I'm saying? So they ended up sending three of my co-defendants back to Alameda County, which is where I'm from. We got caught in a whole nother county. And I remember my mom coming to the courthouse or to the juvenile hall or whatever. And she tried to get me released. And we went before a judge as soon as I got there. And the judge said, no, you're being detained. You're not going anywhere. Even though you're a resident of Alameda County, we're leaving you here in Contra Costa County. The other ones can go. So I knew it was an uphill battle from there, you know. And luckily, I look back and I'm very lucky because I was 17 at the time. This happened in July. My birthday was in September. So that's three months. If this happened 3 months later, I would be charged as an adult.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? They charged me with 8 counts of residential burglary and 3 counts of possession of stolen property. And I was just saying to myself, like, man, I didn't do anything. Why am I being charged with all this stuff? And next thing you know, I'm in my cell. I have a court date coming up in like 2 weeks, I believe. And we end up going back to court. The judge denied my request to get sent to my county because in Alameda County, which is the county I'm from, they're dealing with so much more stuff, you know, murders and, you know, just all kind of stuff,
right.
You know, so.
I was major shit. They're dealing with major shit, you know what I mean? There.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So if they sent me back to my county, I'm going home, maybe probation, maybe ankle monitor for a few months and then I'm free or whatever. You know what I'm saying? So I think the judge was really trying to make me learn a lesson at that particular time. So I was in jail for 3 months, in juvenile hall for 3 months, and then I turned 18 in September. So when I turned 18, my case was still pending. They were still figuring out what to do with me. So they ended up sending me to county jail for about a month and a half. And that was tough, man. That was tough because it was 23-hour lockdown a day. Yeah, and it was tough, man. And the 1 hour they let you out, they don't even tell you. They just come unlock the door. And then next thing you know, you in there with general population and, you know, all kind of shit go down in there. You know what I'm saying? So I had a lot of time to really sit back and really reflect and think about what I want to do with my life. I put myself in that situation and I was going to man up and be like, you know what? I'm finna do what it takes to get out this situation. So right after that, right after my stint at the county jail, my sentencing came up and the judge ended up sending me to the boys ranch for a year. And I was basically thanking God for that, you know, because it could have been a lot more worse. They could have sent me to California Youth Authority. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but that's basically like a prison for minors. You know, they put a lot of time on you. I was looking at 15 years in prison if I was an adult. So for them to give me a year, I was like, okay. I was saying to myself, I'm like, okay, they're giving me this year. I'm just going to take it and run with it. You know, whatever happens, happens. You know, I'm just going to take it and run with it. So I ended up getting to the boys ranch and it was different. You know, it was a transition. A lot of people, a lot of cats I knew in there just from, you know, them knowing who I was from being a star athlete and knowing my situation that I just lost my scholarship. So I was all over the paper. So it was weird when I got there. People was looking at me all weird and just giving me the eye, just trying to figure out who this cat was, you know.
So they knew you. You didn't necessarily know them, but they knew absolutely. You, which almost put absolutely. A bullseye on absolutely. You. Yeah.
So it was a little weird in the beginning. One of the probation officers that I met when I first got there was from Oakland, and he actually coached at one of my rival high schools. So he, you know, rest in peace to Amin Denny. He was very instrumental in me making that transition from being a star athlete to being a regular inmate, just like the rest of the kids. You know what I'm saying? Because it was definitely a transition, man. It was tough in the beginning, but I was one of the only ones who had already graduated from high school. So I had a lot of time on my hands. You know, I was doing laundry. I was doing a lot of cleaning. I was trying to take as many classes as possible just to try to make the days go by. I was even in a welding class, you know, just trying to weigh out my options, man. And I was just thankful that I was able to have a second opportunity and not have my life just thrown away just off of one mistake.
Right.
And D-Best, did you think football was over at that point for you, man? Did you think that there was that was the last thing on your mind at that point, I'm sure, right?
Well, when I was incarcerated at the county jail, I thought it was over, man. But I didn't give up, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, I thought, you know, football is out the picture. Let me focus on me and my life right now. You know what I'm saying? And I had some strong people in my life, you know, that I would call and talk to that, you know, that was praying for me, that was keeping me upbeat, keeping me focused, keeping me appreciative of the situation. You know what I'm saying? As bad as that sounds, as far as me being incarcerated, it could have been a lot worse. You know, I could have been dead or shot or something, you know, just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know what I mean? So people, you know, I had some, you know, my mother was one of them, you know, she kept it real with me and just, you know, made me realize how blessed I really was for really getting a second chance going to the Byron Boys Ranch. You know what I'm saying? So,
and speaking of football in the ranch, you found football there, right? They had a 7-on-7 league. You know, I you ever see that movie Gridiron Gang with The Rock?
Yep.
That's what it kind of reminded me of when I saw those highlight videos. So uh-huh. How did that come about? And you look like you were just eating, man, on those games.
Well, that's where I say I was really thankful to have a second chance to go to the ranch, you know, because it was, believe it or not, they gave you a lot of opportunities that most kids didn't have, you know, in their everyday life. You know what I'm saying? So, like I said, I was doing welding. You know, I was feeding animals and I was watering the grass. I was cleaning. I was doing my own line. I was doing everybody's laundry. You know, it just opened my eyes. But they had a lot of sports teams as well that traveled, and you would get permission from the judge to go to other campsites and play against them. So, I was all in with that. You know, I was playing volleyball, I was playing softball, flag football, basketball. I was doing whatever I can to make my time go by faster.
Sure.
And like I said, with Amin Denny, he was really instrumental in me making that transition from being a, you know, a superstar to being, you know, a detainee. And they started this flag football team, and, you know, I was all in. It was a guy by the name of Don Burgess, a guy that I talk to every day to this day. And he was the head coach. And he was just like, man, D-Best, we know your background. We know what you can do. You the man, whatever you want to do, just make it happen, you know.
So you're running your own offense, huh?
Exactly. Encourage your teammates. Just go out and have fun. Enjoy the moment. Live in the moment, you know. So that's what I did. So I was going around to these different local campsites, and I was just eating, man. I was just, you know, I found a guy in there that can throw the ball. So he became one of my best friends, you know what I'm saying? So I was like, just feed me, man. I was running my routes, getting open, catching the ball, yak, everything, you know? And it was a lot of fun, you know, believe it or not, you know, with the situation I was in, it just brought joy to me.
Yeah, that don't even seem like it was even fair in there, D-Best. I don't even know, you know what I mean? That don't even seem right there, man.
Yeah, hey, you got to do what you got to do sometimes, man, you know? So
absolutely.
Like I said, man, it was a lot of fun, you know. A lot of the cats in there looked up to me, you know, for them to be playing alongside of me. It boosts their confidence, not only on the football field, but in life, you know, because I was preaching I was like the preacher in there, you know, about right. getting your shit together, you know, get your high school diploma, get your GED, whatever it is you want to do in life, you can do it. You know, we all in here. Look at me. I'm a prime example. I come from Oakland, California. I was getting ready to have a scholarship to go to college, and I'm in here with you now. So that doesn't make me any better than you. You know what I mean? So a lot of them guys looked up to me, man, and it felt good, you know, because I was practicing what I was preaching as well myself, you know.
And, you know, it had to feel good. And you talk about eating, you know, in that 707 and, you know, and bouncing around those camps and killing kids, man. And, you know, you talked about Coach Beam a little bit. Let's talk about his relationship, man, with June Jones and University of Hawaii, man. And, mm-hmm. you know, give you that shot to light it up, man. I mean, you lit it up in college, man. 41 touchdowns in 3 seasons. I mean, what was that second chance like, man? And you know, I really want to know, how was it living in paradise as well while doing this, bro, for 3 years? That had to be a lot of fun, man.
Yeah, man. It was, man, I tell you, it was a blessing, man. It was such a blessing. So my route to University of Hawaii all started when Coach Beam basically told me, listen, if you don't man up to what you did, I'm done with you. I wrote him a few letters and, you know, I kind of, you know, I beat around the bush and told him I had nothing to do with it or whatever. And on the, I think it was my fourth letter I sent to him, I was like, Coach, I need you, man. I need your help. I apologize for not being truthful, for not being honest, but, you know, I did pick them up. I was a driver. I knew what I was doing. I was just being a good friend, trying to do the wrong thing. So I finally, you know, told him the truth. Like, you know, I admitted my involvement in the situation. And that very, I want to say like a week or two later, he came out and visited me. So we sat down and we mapped out a plan. This is what we're going to do. We're going to get you on tape because the graduate assistant at University of Hawaii at the time, he played for Coach Beam at Skyline High School as well. So that was basically my connection, my foot in the door. So he ended up coming to one of the 707 passing tournaments that we were planning, and he brought a camera. And he was just like, you know, he was like, man, just do your thing. I'm going to just film you. And you just do your thing. Have fun. Kick back. Relax. Make plays and do what you do. And I was like, all right, I'm cool. You know, so I wasn't about to let that opportunity slip, you know. So I ended up balling that game. You know, I had about 5 touchdowns. I was playing safe, a little safety. I had a couple picks. You know, I was just all over the field, you know. So he ended up taking that tape back to June Jones, to University of Hawaii. And Coach Jones saw the tape. He saw me doing everything, catching passes, intercepting passes, playing a little quarterback. And he was like, man, what is this guy's situation? When is he getting out? He wanted to know more. So Coach Beam basically bridged that gap, man. And I got out in September of 2004, and I ended up going to Hawaii, I want to say a month later, on an unofficial visit, and basically just stayed out there, right, man.
I come back. It's Hawaii, man.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you one thing. It was a culture shock in the beginning. It was definitely a culture shock in the beginning. I didn't know nobody. I'm fresh from a detention facility, and I'm straight in paradise. Like, things wasn't clicking, you know, right away. But one thing that did resonate to me was that, okay, you got a second chance. What you going to do with it? You know, you got to make the most of it now. You know what I'm saying? So I wasn't, you know, I was on the straight and narrow, man. I had my blinders up. I was staying focused. I was doing whatever I could to basically get this scholarship and make the most of my second chance, man.
So, made the most of Juice, 41 TDs.
Yeah, the most. He made the hell of most, right?
How do you sign up for that offense? Absolutely. Were you calling your own plays in Hawaii too, man? It sounds like you're running the same offense that you were running in the
I know, right? Man, hey, I tell you one thing, though. When I got to Hawaii, like I said, I didn't know nobody. So I was just always around the football guys. You know what I'm saying? That was my family, you know? Was Coach Rolovic. He's the head coach at Washington State right now, but he was the quarterback's coach, or he was doing something around the program when I first got there. And we were on the field, and I was just eating guys up, you know, catching slants, catching curls, going over the top, one-handed catches, everything. And he went to Coach Jones literally after that practice or after that workout and said, coach, you need to sign this guy immediately. So that basically solidified my scholarship going to University of Hawaii. I had a few roadblocks people don't know about, but the NCAA clearinghouse didn't clear me right away. And that was another hurdle I was going through, you know, right. And I look at it like it's simple. It was a simple mindset for me. It was like these hurdles and these situations come up, and it's like, whatever you do, just get over it, you know, work to jump over that hurdle, work for the next opportunity, work for whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish and do. So I ended up getting cleared by the clearinghouse, thank God. Next thing you know, Coach Jones offered me a scholarship. And from there, I just basically worked my tail off, man. I was just doing things that guys had never seen before. You know, I was the first guy out at practice catching balls off the jug machine, the last guy to leave. I'm walking through routes. I'm in the film room asking questions. Because the year before, it was Timmy Chang and Chad Owens, you know, all these guys, they were all seniors. So the offense was wide open. It was a new class coming in, and nobody had officially a starting spot. You know, you had to work during camp, during spring, during camp. And Coach Jones basically made us all compete. We was all freshmen. So I prided myself on working hard and trying to be that guy, you know, and it definitely paid off, man.
Well, clearly it paid off in a lot of different ways. I mean, a spectacular college career. And you know, I say that and we can read statistics, but like you said, wait a second, Seth, I just came out of a juvenile facility. You know, I just spent a year, 13, 14 months, whatever it is. Then you're in Hawaii and lighting things up. Draft didn't go the way you wanted it to, but as our listeners all know, you end up signing with the Dolphins as an undrafted free agent in 2008 and just continue to tear shit up, man. Second most receptions in NFL history by a rookie wide receiver, rookie free agent wide receiver with 54. You make an immediate impact. What led you to Miami? Were there other offers? Was Miami the only team that called you after you didn't get drafted? So I'm wondering what led you to Miami and how did you find such early success?
Well, it was a weird draft process. I ended up picking my agent right after the Sugar Bowl. We went to the Sugar Bowl and played Georgia in 07. And we end up getting smacked. So the very next day, I ended up declaring for the draft and I signed with my agent. He flew me out to Arizona, where I live now currently. And I train at a place called API, Athlete Performance Institution or something like that. I forget the name of it. But I was there with all the top picks. And ironically, I was training with Jake Long. Who knew that we'd
really
be teammates one day? You know what I'm saying? But I was there.
Should have been Matt Ryan, but that's a different story. But Jake's a hell of a player.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm there with all the top guys. And, you know, I'm like, okay. I submitted my take to the NFL board or whatever, and they gave me a second round grade. So my agent was like, okay, one thing, okay, let's talk about what you can do or what are the benefits of coming out. You had three successful seasons at Hawaii. You were healthy. And just personally, I was just ready for the next step in my life, man. I was just ready for that next challenge, you know. So he was like, just come out, you know, and then, you know, we'll see where it goes. And plus my quarterback, Colt Brennan, I think he was leaving as well, you know. So I was like, there's really no sense in coming back, you know what I mean? So got the second round grade, training went good, got to the combine and I ran a 4.6. I was really disappointed because I was expecting to run in the high 4.4s. 4.5 at the slowest, and I ended up running the 4.6, and that kind of killed my draft status because guys knew I can play. They knew I can catch. They knew I can run routes. They knew I can read coverages. They knew I had the whole package. They just want to see how fast I was, and you know how it is. NFL is all about speed and how fast you can run at the combine. You know?
And size, right? Size and speed.
And size, right.
You're a smaller guy.
Absolutely. So I basically, I shit the bed on the 40-yard dash. Ended up doing really well at my pro day. I ran a 4.49 at my pro day, but I ended up pulling my hamstring doing so. So I wasn't able to work out and run routes for the guys at the pro day. And we had every team there, every team, because my quarterback, he was the man. You know, he broke a whole bunch of records in college, and everybody really wanted to see him. So they wanted to see who he was throwing to as well. So I wasn't able to work out in front of guys. So it's funny. I ended up getting a call from the Atlanta Falcons in the third round. And I was like, okay, this is going to be it. This is going to be the call. You know, I was training with Matt Ryan at API. This may be a good fit, you know. And the receivers coach called. He was like, man, we thinking about taking you with this next pick. And he was like, but we don't know for sure yet. So just hold tight, hold tight. I'm like, all right, cool. So I'm holding tight. Next thing you know, the sixth round comes up, no phone call. Oh, next thing you know, seventh round comes up. My phone is blowing up. And I'm like, this is weird. Why is all these teams calling me? The draft not even over yet. You know what I'm saying? And I'm thinking they finna call to select me. Almost every team called me literally towards the end of the seventh round, trying to figure out where I was going to go for a free agent spot. And Miami was the most intriguing because that year they didn't draft any receivers, you know. And one, my agent said that too. He was like, this may be a good fit because, you know, they didn't draft any receivers, you know. They got a new coaching staff, you know, so that nobody's biased, nobody's had favorites. You just got to go out there and work and do your thing and show up. So I ended up signing with the Dolphins.
They didn't tell you they're going to run like a wildcat for half the season, though. They didn't.
Yeah, they didn't say that. They didn't say
there's
that.
No receivers, but that's because we got 18 running backs in the backfield.
right, exactly. If I would have known that, man, I don't know where I'd be right now.
right. Speaking of receivers, though, we called Camarillo and told him we were having you on. He sends his best, man. He was so happy to hear that you were diving in. But he said that year it was really you, Teddy Ginn, and Greg. And he said that he'd never been in a receiver room where the guys all worked together. There was no animosity. Nobody.
He said
Carl Durrell put you guys in charge of rotation. Juice, have you ever heard of such a thing? They just would rotate on their own.
Yeah.
And then the catches were like 56, 55, 54. And that's what Greg said. I didn't go check that. So, but I know what Devon's catches were. As a young guy, not only getting a lot of catches, but to be in a room where you don't have these vets. We've heard the Duriel Harris stories where he wouldn't do anything to help out Duper and Clayton. Guys that are working with you like that. How was that for you?
Well, it was special, man, because, you know how it is. Like you said, man, if, you know, you're the rookie coming in, they know that you're trying to come and get their job. And it's serious. So they don't want to do nothing to help you. But we was in a unique situation because all of us were young. We were unproven. And the coaches, they wanted to see who was going to succeed out of the battle. You know what I'm
almost
saying?
Almost sounds so, like Hawaii again, your freshman year.
Absolutely. And it like just like you said, just like Hawaii. So it was a familiar situation for me, you know, and it just brought me back to my Hawaii days and helped me realize you got to work to, if you want to get on the field, you got to work and do what you did before, you know. So like I said, it was a familiar environment. And Camarillo, Ted Ginn, Ernest Wilford, Derek Hagan, all of those guys were really helpful to me. You know, they came up to me and were asking me, you know, D, I know you don't got nobody out here. You want to come to the house on a day off. You want to, Ted offered me to spend a night, you know, if I didn't have nowhere to stay. Greg offered to take me out to eat. You know, it was just, it was very welcoming, you know, and it really made our relationship special, not only on the field, but off the field as well.
Yeah, I know, you know, Seth, you talk about, you know, why he chose Miami, man. You can't go from Hawaii to Green Bay. You got to go. You got to at least find some equivalent,
absolutely,
you know, somewhat.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So Miami's definitely that thing.
I say the good Lord has been on my side, man, to go from Cali to Hawaii to Miami. I can't complain. You know what I'm saying?
You're definitely on the all-weather team for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about Hawaii, man. And of course, you know, you met your wife while you were out there. And clearly you were totally immersed in the culture out there too, man. And, you know, I'm told that carried over to the league a little bit, and that you and Big Paul Soli were very close as well, you know, here
That's
in Miami. In fact, you know, we had Big Ronnie Brown in the tank, and he said you guys used to party together a little bit. And one night at the Hard Rock, you know, you might have been spotted shirtless doing the haka dance. Talk about the haka.
Wait a minute.
Oh, my God.
Haka
was shirt off.
That was coming up. I knew that was coming up. But you know what? When I was in college, Coach Jones, he like during camp, he would leave like an extra like 20 minutes extra after practice for us to practice this haka dance. And, you know, you got guys from L.A., you guys got guys from Texas, you know, all over. we ain't never seen this dance before. You know, we like, man, what is this? You know, but we bought into it. You know, yeah. We opened our hearts, you know, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun, man. But like the story about Ronnie saying I was doing a haka. It's funny because that might have been the night that I found out I made the team. So we all went out to the Hard Rock and had a good time, man. I had a few, and I, you know what? I don't even remember, but I might have done it for sure. You know, you know how it is, man. You're a rookie. You just made the team. You know,
yeah, right.
Man, everything was good, man. But that culture definitely left the impact on my life. You know, like my wife is Hawaiian, and from the food to the people, you know, everything is just all love. You know, everybody puts family first. You know, which how it should be.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it's literally like a hang loose lifestyle. You know, just kick back, no stress, no worries, and just
no
enjoy
shirt.
Life and be thankful. You know, no shirt. You know,
that's awesome though, man. Do you still know it? Do you still got the haka down a little bit?
You know what, man? It's been some years, man. If I see it, I can get a good feel for it, but it's been a while, man. It's all definitely right. Been a while.
We'll yeah, so D Best, I see. Is that the dance we see the team do a lot still? Like, is it pre and post game a lot of times, or how do they?
Most of the times it's pre game. You know, if I'm not mistaken, it's to like you're calling on the ancestors and the gods to come down and help give you strength to take over your opponent. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And it puts fear in your opponent when they see those Samoans and those Polynesians, like literally, like. Into it, you know what I'm saying? It's very intimidating.
That's awesome, man.
That's great. There's some great ones on YouTube, especially like that rugby and, you know, those New Zealand teams.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God. Those,
yes.
Those are the ones, man.
That's like
you check those boys out, they full throttle with it, you know.
Well, we need D Best. If he ever comes back in the tank, you got to practice your hockey, man. You got to practice it. But so speaking of Big Paul, we did reach out to him. I wanted to verify that story. But he also said, he goes, ask him about the barbecues at my house, the Friday night barbecues.
Oh, man. The barbecues were amazing, man. Like, I think that's one, you know, besides my journey, you know, making the team and you know, having success in the field, bonding with the boys. I think that's one of the things I miss the most is, like, the barbecues we would have at his house, man. They were epic, man. I don't know if y'all ever heard of what is it called? Kava? Have you ever heard of kava?
Not me.
It's like a root or something they mash up or whatever. And
that sounds like some other shit.
Yeah, man. Yeah, for real. But like it's like a root or something you mash up and it turns into like a paste or pudding or something.
Oh, wow.
And you sip on it, you know. Even the guys would do it when I was in college, and I always wondered, you know, what are they doing? What is that? You know what I'm saying? But I never indulged in it at all until I got to Miami, man. And man, it's a different feeling, man. But it was a lot of fun. Paul Soliai introduced me to that.
That's great. That's awesome. You know, we just had B. Marsh in the tank as well, man. And of course, I mean, you guys were a sick ass 1-2 punch in 2010. I mean, you got 165 balls between the two of you. But B. Marsh also admitted that, you know, it was a difficult season for him. And he specifically discussed an incident with Coach Carl Durrell we talked about before, calling him out in a meeting and said that he preferred your game, D. Best, over B. Marsh's. Do you remember that?
Oh,
and if so, how awkward was that? That had to be pretty awkward.
It was very awkward, man. I remember that like it was yesterday. But, you know, when B. Marshall first got there, I was one of the first ones in the locker room to, like, introduce myself because I was excited for him to come because I knew we got this big guy catching 100 balls a year. You know, I wasn't looking at it like he's stealing my shine. I was looking at it like we're going to help each other. You know, right. I needed this. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And it was going to take my game to the next level. So I was excited, man. And, you know, he struggled a little bit, you know, just, I don't know if you know, the whole mental health thing was part of it initially. Yeah, but
he said it was. He definitely said it was.
Yeah, I didn't know because I didn't really go into it that deep with him. But
right.
Initially I did when we first met, you know, in the first few years, I didn't, you know, that was off limits.
I don't think he knew at that point either, though, D. Bass. I don't think he knew at that point either. I think that's what he came to a realization with. You know what I mean?
For sure. Brandon would say things that, you know, most people wanted to say, but they didn't say it, you know, and most of the times he was right, believe it or not. And he had a strong personality. And I looked up to Brandon a lot because he was, you know, people saw his success on the field, but they didn't see the work that he put in. You know, Brandon worked his ass off, you know, and that pushed me. That made me a better player. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, when Coach Carl Durrell, when he did that, it definitely put me in an awkward situation, but it made me think to myself, okay, you're doing the right thing. You need to keep going. You know, you
makes
need to
sense.
Stay focused, keep working, stay humble, keep grinding, do whatever it is that got you here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, good stuff, man. That was a great conversation, man. And it's good that you can validate, you know, some of the things he said about, you know, because it's been said that he said things that most people wanted to say, but you even said it best that he was right most of the time when he said that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. So apparently Ricky told him the same thing because he went to Ricky knowing everything Ricky had been through.
Right.
Ricky's like, he asked Ricky if he was bipolar. He said, I just think that you're going to, you know, there's no filter. You're going to say the things that maybe you shouldn't say, but people want to say. So, well, look, man, we've had a lot of fun here today, but we also know, and you and I talked about this the other day on the phone, there's a very serious and difficult side to your story. And for those listening, those Dolphin fans who cheered for you every day that you wore aqua and orange, all they know is after five productive seasons here, you were traded to the Browns and things really kind of went sideways. I don't know how much you want to get into it, Devon, but I wanted to at least give you an opportunity because what we realize is that there's always another side of the story that folks don't know, that the guys who are going through it and battling and living it are having to deal with. And so, you know, it's on you how comfortable you are talking about what happened, but there were things where we just watched and it all, you know, for those who knew you, I could just speak personally, it was hurtful to watch you going through those things and not knowing what was going on. I'm like, this isn't the guy that I went to visit schools with. And so there's been a lot of trials and tribulations post-career and not just the things before your career. So do you want to talk about any of that stuff and kind of what you went through?
Absolutely, man. First and foremost, man, looking back, I realized your mental clarity has to be right if you want to be successful in whatever it is that you want to do in life. Football player, doctor, lawyer, broadcaster, whatever it is you want to do, your mental has to be just as sharp as your physical, whatever you're doing. But with that being said, I want to say 2011 was the beginning of it, you know, and a lot of people didn't know because I bottled a lot of stuff up. You know, and which I know now is not healthy at all. You know, it's just a recipe for disaster.
Right.
But with that being said, it all started with me tearing my ACL. Now, if you look back in my career, going back to high school, I've never missed a game. You know, never missed a game. I prided myself on being healthy and being a key factor to help my team win. So I tore my ACL in 2011. I want to say a month later, my brother got shot in Oakland, almost passed, you know, and this is my younger brother. You know, my mom only had two kids, me and him. With that being said, me and my wife wasn't on the best of terms. So we was contemplating divorce. You know, we was just not seeing eye to eye. You know, I was just doing a lot of things, you know, with whether it was foundation work, community service, being at practice, studying, doing extra stuff. You know, we were just not seeing eye to eye. We had two young kids at the time, you know, so it was just a lot of pressure on her looking back that, you know, that I caused. You know what I'm saying? So with that being said, fast forward to 2012. I ended up hurting my back. I fractured a vertebrae in my back in the San Francisco game. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have, you know, solid individuals in my corner to really keep me in the right mindset. Because looking back, I had a lot of, you know, they call it yes men, you know. Mm-hmm. They call it yes men, your boys, your crew, right. Do whatever you say, don't correct you. You know, when you're wrong, you know, long as you're taking care of them, everything is good. But with that being said, everything was just building up. Me and my father fell out. Well, this is not my biological father. This is my brother's dad. My stepfather. Me and my stepfather ended up falling out over finances. It was, man, it was just so much stuff that hit me at one time. I remember one particular incident. Coach Philbin came up to me and he mentioned something about, you know, are you okay? You know, what's going on or whatever. And I just fired off at him. I'm like, you know, forget you, man. You know, you're not here for me. Nobody's here for me. I just checked out. I was completely out of it, man. I ended up walking from the bubble into the facility. He followed me and he's telling me, he's like, man, whatever it is you're going through, I can help you, you know, with his situation, with his son in the passing,
right.
You know.
Right.
So he was kind of telling me about that, you know, and I didn't want to hear it. You know, I was just in a lonely place. I wasn't getting, you know, as many balls as I would like. You know, I was feeling sorry for myself. Stuff wasn't right at home. I was self-medicating at the time, which a lot of people know, you know,
right.
It wasn't benefiting me at all. Looking back, you know, it was just making me worse, you know, making everything worse. And I was just a ticking time bomb, man. And long story short, you know, everything caught up with me. It caught up with me. I wasn't getting any sleep. I had thoughts racing through my head about, you know, all kinds of stuff. I was getting paranoid. I was really, really in a long, lonely, lonely, deep, deep depression, you know, and it was challenging, man. It was challenging. So with that being said, you can ask me whatever you want to, you know, about the situation. And then I'll just continue to go forward.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. I mean, there were, you know, real we don't have to right go there, into it. It really shit, is. And I appreciate you being so honest hell about yeah. it, Devon. I know, you know, we knew there was an incident at an airport with a police officer.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, the stuff happened on Twitter. And of course, the first thing we all do, right, guys who've been around a locker room, we want to laugh. Oh, let Devon do it, you know. But then we start to see things to add up and add up and add up.
Right.
You know, and it becomes a concern. And so, right before, after you and I spoke, Johnny sent me the, I guess, this documentary that you had put together. And I don't know if that has aired or not, but it kind of was mind blowing. All the stuff that happened after you and I had a chance to work together. But the thing that struck me here, and you know, maybe you can connect these dots, was, you know, we talk about the success story of how you did fall down in school and you had to go to the juvenile center. And then life just took off, and what a great story. You know, he went to jail, but yet he went to Hawaii and became a superstar and had this great NFL career. But you said, yo, I never got a chance to process that shit. Like, I went from jail to Hawaii to the NFL and never had a chance to process and heal. Talk about that, and how, what did it take for you to figure that out?
Absolutely, man. Like, you know, I train kids on the side out here, and one of the things I always preach to them, you know, besides running routes and catching balls, whenever you go through life, whenever you go through a hurdle or something or a situation, whether it's good or bad, you got to stop and reflect for a minute, you know. And I wish I would have done that. I wish, looking back, I wish I would have, you know, they call it stopping and smelling the roses. You know, I use that term, stop and smell the roses, you know, because it's very important for your mental health. There were so many times where, you know, I would get distracted, you know, whether it's been at practice, been at a foundation event, I was just doing so much. I never sat back and reflected on all the hurdles that I actually went over. You know, everything was just being bottled up. I was just going right from one thing to the other, one thing to the other, one thing to the other. And eventually my brain was just on overload, you know, and I've never been in that situation where I didn't know how to respond. You know, I didn't know how to react. I didn't have the right, like I said, I didn't have the right people around me at the time that I needed for me to be healthy, you know, from a mental standpoint. So I think it was, it was the mental overload, you know. To this day, they've never, like, the doctors never pinpointed and said exactly what it was. The closest thing to it was that I had a mental breakdown, you know. Mm. And it's funny, I don't mean to say funny, but it's ironic that I've had a mental breakdown because my mom went through the same thing.
Really?
As a kid, you know, when I was a kid and when she was younger, I remember her going, you know, having a mental breakdown, just being, wow. you know, being so having an overload of thoughts and just everything racing and whatever she was going through in her life. The same thing happened with me, man. So with that being said, you know, like I said, your mental health is everything, you know.
Yeah, right.
And even though I'm doing so much better now, and I'm in a much, much better place than I was some years back, but it's important to have the right group of people around you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to talk about your issues, you know, talk about your problems, talk about whatever it is that you're going through, you know. And me and my wife talk about this to this day. Like, she always tell me, you know, it's not your fault. You wasn't raised with the proper tools to be able to communicate when something is wrong, you know. And I told her, you're right, because
you
play football, you play sports, you're the man on your team. You're so used to being this macho figure, you know, just this tough guy, you know, whatever it is, you know. And you're never taught the other side to be able to breathe and talk about your feelings and be able to express how you feel when something's not right, man.
Yeah, D-Best, man, it's so well put, man. So many people don't understand what, you know, everybody thinks that athletes have it so good all the time, you know, and they don't realize that there are the human side of being an athlete with so much pressure on you. Talk about, you know, having to provide for your family, falling out with your stepdad, you know, your boys being around, you know, all that pressure of having to be the man all the damn time, man. And they don't realize that it does play a role and it takes a toll on you mentally, physically, and
emotionally,
we're supposed to be emotionally, everything about it, man. And a relationship wise, you know, and people don't get that, man. They think that you're playing a damn game. You're playing a fucking sport. You're making all this money. What's your problem? You know what I mean?
Right.
And they don't
right.
get that part of it. You know what I mean?
Right. And you summed it up, man. Like when my stepdad, you know, was calling and showing his ass, you know, talking all kind of crazy stuff, you know, asking for money, saying, you know, you owe me this, you owe me that. That shit broke my heart, man, you know, because I never viewed him like that, you know. And they say money changed people. Money definitely changed people, man. Yeah. And they say, you know, the athletes and whoever got the money changed, but 99% of the time it's the people around you that changed, man.
Yes,
you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I witnessed that firsthand, you know, and you know, I don't put the, you know, I own up to my actions and, you know, the situation that I was in and what I've been through. I'm not putting the blame on him, but what I'm saying is, That was definitely a mental blow to my ego, you know, to me, you know, for this person that I love, this person that I've looked up to my whole life, to treat me like this and to be talking bad on me and saying I owe him this and I owe him that. I didn't know how to respond to that. So I went into a deep, deep depression. And, you know, he wasn't the only one. You know, I had family members coming out the woodwork that I didn't even know. You know, even my biological father was coming into the picture, you know, and, you know, we have a conversation. 5 minutes later, he's already asking for money, you know.
Right.
So
fuck.
I started looking at it in the big picture, like people just look at me like a bank. So I started cutting people off. I start being to myself, you know, I start being by myself, which wasn't good.
Yeah, that's not healthy.
Which isn't good, you know, and. It really sank me into a deep, deep, deep depression, man. And, you know, like you said, the incident at the airport, everything is like, it's a blurry to me, you know, everything is blurry to me. But one thing I do remember is, you know, when, you know, I was dancing or whatever I was listening to music and the officer basically said, look, I don't know what's going on with you, but you can't do that here. And I was so out of it. I just remember him hitting me with a baton and them arresting me, bro. And I look back and my brother was with me at the time. And he was just like, you know, I talked to him about it, you know, some years ago. Like, I'm saying to myself, like, why didn't you come get me or why didn't you grab me? And he was like, bro, you was out of it, man. I was trying to talk to you. I was trying to get you to calm down. I was trying to get you to, you know, to exit or do whatever it is, but it wasn't no controlling you. It was one of them situations where I had to learn on my own, you know, and I've been in that situation before, you know, where I had to basically man up and suffer and pay the consequences on my own, you know. So like I said, man, I don't blame anybody for, you know, for anything that I've been through, but I blame myself for not keeping the right company around me and for being alone by myself and self-medicating and just, you know, things like that, man.
Well, you know what, D-Best, man, you know, you always one of my favorites, man. I didn't realize until really today how much in common we had. You know, we both had a mom who had gave birth to us at age 15. Wow. We both had a dad that tried to come in and, you know, when the money was good and try to get back in the picture, you know what I mean? But I think the fact that you're able to face all those things that you went through and you know, hit them head on, man, it's pretty awesome. And, you know, we've talked about a lot of that stuff, man, but let's try to end this thing on a positive note, bro, because there's a lot of positive, man, that I got from you, watching you on the football field, but also all the things that you continue to do in the community. You talked about that a little bit and how much you embrace the community. I know you and I did a Halloween event together and stuff about that.
Yep, my
favorite. You know what I mean? Had a blast. The Grand Ghoul, which is postponed because of COVID this year, unfortunately.
But
we'll be back at it again next year. One of Seth's favorite events of all time, man.
So, Devon, you used to host it. You know how bad things are now? I co-host it with Juice. That's how it used to be. A-list, man.
Downgrade. We downgraded a lot.
Downgrade. Me a little crumbs over there.
Nah, Seth is a cool dude, man. I'm sure he had his own.
Oh, he's good, man. He's really good. He makes me look good up there, bro. So that's the truth.
I ain't selling any tickets, though. They're not buying it to come see me.
So, D-Vez, let's talk about your Best Route Foundation, man, and some of the favorite projects that you were able to accomplish, and you know how much that giving back to the community and how much it means to you, because you're still training kids, you mentor kids, you know how important it is for kids to see guys like you and what you've gone through and hear what you've done and still be successful in life.
Absolutely, man. You know, it all started with a vision, you know. I'm real big on going, you know, going back into my roots and understanding, you know, where I come from, how I was raised or whatever, you know. And when in 2011, when we first launched the foundation, we didn't know exactly what direction we want to go in. We just know we want to help kids, you know. And, you know, thanks to Johnny, thanks to Seth, you know, and my boy CK, we all got together and we created something really, really special. And I'm not, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, the situation, we all know what happened to me and, you know, what I was doing. So I had to kind of put that on pause or whatever, but it's my pride and joy, you know, giving back, you know, talking to the kids, you know, just letting them know my story and the different hurdles that I had to overcome to be where I am, you know. And even though that I bumped my head a few times, I'm still on the path to help out and give back whatever I can, you know, whether it's, you know, like I do now, coaching kids about running routes and reading coverages, or I'm going to the libraries, donating books, going to the inner city, talking to kids about making the right decisions, you know, giving 100% to whatever you're doing, hanging with the right people, you know, just constantly preaching about my life and my story, you know, and how I can intervene, you know, and stop guys from bumping their head, from learning a hard mistake, you know. So it's just my passion. It's something, you know, that I grew up always wanting to do, because, you know, the inner city and, you know, having the Boys and Girls Clubs and the different facilities and stuff really helped me a lot. You know, like I said, my mom was young when she had me, so she had to work. She wasn't always there, but, you know, she always signed me up in sports. She always had me at the local YMCA. She always had me in school, you know. And those things help mold me into the person I am today. And I just want to pay it forward and give back, you know, in the best way possible.
The best way possible, right?
Best route possible.
You know what? He did. And Juice, I got to say this, because I was fortunate enough to have a chance to see it front and center. I think Devon had come to some of the stuff we were doing with JT's Foundation. And at the time we were working with Ronnie Brown and with his 23 Ways to Stop Youth Violence. And Devon said, actually, Johnny Williams reached out to me and said, hey, Devon and his trainer, who was CK, they have this vision. And we talked a lot about it. We met a lot about it. And, you know, full transparency, I got a way of doing things and Johnny's got a way of doing things. And CK's got his own way of doing things. And sometimes we butted heads. But the message, it's fun looking back at it now. But the message that you and CK had, that you guys had, was really spectacular. And just they got in front of thousands and thousands of kids across Dade and Broward And it was really spectacular to see it. And there's something about, and the more Preacher and I work with young people, it's one thing to have a great program, but it's another thing to model behavior. And for them to see Devon and hear his story and know that he walked a certain path, made mistakes, owned up to those mistakes, and still was able to overcome, it just resonated with them. And so it was really, it was an honor for me to be a part of it. And it's really wonderful to hear you talk about, you know, especially everything that's happened after that, to hear these things and that you right. continue to try and to use your story, good and bad, to motivate folks. So, man, I commend you on that. And I'm just, it's such a pleasure to have this time with you. I was so happy when I found out. Devon was like, yeah, man, let's do it.
Oh, awesome,
let's set up a call. Let's talk about it.
I appreciate it. This is actually my first or second interview, you know, just really talking about what happened post football. You know what I'm saying? So, and I know the fans, and I know a lot of people down in South Florida was wondering, you know, what happened to Devon and is he okay and all of that. So this was a great opportunity to kind of put everything out on the table and let everybody know, man, I'm doing awesome, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. That is awesome. I'm so happy to hear that, man. And thank you. Thank you so much for just being willing to not just come on the show, but to be so candid and forthcoming.
Yeah, the best, man. Been the realest shit ever, man. And we appreciate it, man. And thanks for diving in with us today, brother.
No problem, man. I appreciate y'all. If I can do it again, just hit me up and let me know.
All right, we're holding you to it.
That's right.
He said that and dipped.
I'm out. I thought
he said that. He's like, please.
Drop the mic.
Use my number.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, golf fans, number one, of course y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk, dive up in that fish tank, go get your aqua orange, yeah it's time to dive up in that fish tank, it's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank, rocking with OJ and Seth when we dive up in that fish tank. Okay, this one for them diehards. Celebrate big or cry hard. Leave it all on the field, we gon' try hard. Old school, a new school, mix it in. Feeling like we up close when we listening. Dolphins tales, in Miami is the deep end. We vibing with our favorite players, no secret. We get with Seth and McDuffie, bringing up stories we never heard to the public. Bet we love it, Dolphins fans never budget. We loyal to the team, whether happy or we upset. We be like, what's next? Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you ready for that water, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject, you know it's all about them fins. And if you down with Dolphins Nation, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject, you know it's all about them fins. You looking at that fish tank, it's time to dive in. Fish tank. Go get your aqua orange, yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rapping with OJ and Seth, time to dive up.